about another future being possible, there's a big question that comes up. And one is, isn't it dangerous to invest so much into an individual leader for any movement that actually is talking about freeing all of humanity, to invest so much into an individual leader? And then the other question that comes up related to that is one that I think too often, I think the left, and particularly the left that has supported the socialism as it has existed in both the Soviet Union and China, I think, you know, is timid about speaking to this. And that's the question of Stalin. And I know every time I talk about the future in socialism, I get lots of very thoughtful emails from folks asking me about Stalin and what I thought about what happened under Stalin. And I thought this is a really good way to get into this, to actually lay out some of, some thinking on it, some very, I think, unique and provocative thinking. So that's what I asked Chairman Avakian, was those two questions, and that's what you're going to hear now. This is Bob Avakian, the Chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
Well, let's move into this question about the world and what it could be. And one of the things that every time I've played a couple times the interview that you did with Carl Dix, the national spokesperson of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's interesting. On the one hand, you get the sense of people really wanting another world, like you're saying. On the other hand, you also get a sense immediately when the question of communism comes up, or the question of, you know, that kind of Maoism that comes up. You get people talking about immediately equating that with totalitarianism and raising in opposition to that, you know, this thing of, well, we want democracy. And I think one of the big questions that it begins with is actually a question about leadership, both about a vanguard, but also about individual leaders. And it's come out in relation to you in particular, but it's also come out in general when people talk about, isn't it dangerous, for instance, to invest so much in one leader? Isn't that a very dangerous thing for creating a new world?
Well, it depends on what you mean by investing so much in one leader. If you recognize that, you know, as happens, that leaders do emerge who play an outstanding role, who represent a concentration of understanding of the way the world is and how it can and should be changed on a higher level than others around them at a given time, then that can be a very positive thing. To have something like that and to recognize it can be a very positive thing, and it requires people to rally to that and defend it at the same time as it requires them to come forward and play their own role in this struggle. And so it depends on what you mean by relying on. If you mean putting everything in the hands of a few people and everybody else passively follows them, or just, you know, leaves all the thinking to them, yes, that's not a good thing. Or uncritically follows them, or, you know, doesn't try to wrestle with the same kind of problems that they're trying to wrestle with. Just as we were just talking about, like this question of how to go up against these imperialists. I don't know the answer to all that. I don't think anyone does. You know, we're going to have to learn in practice and by, you know, as things get to that stage in various places in the world, and eventually here, we're going to have to learn in practice, but we also have to be studying theory and, you know, history to learn. And it's not just something that one or a few people should be doing. A lot of people, very broadly, should be wrangling with this and contributing to it. So that there's a unity there, as well as a contradiction between, on the one hand, someone who does come forward, who, you know, has an advanced understanding and does concentrate, as I said, you know, on a higher level than others, at the same time a certain understanding of how the world is and how it can be changed, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the role of a lot of other people and growing numbers of people in taking up the same approach to changing the world, the same communist outlook and methodology, and making the biggest contribution they can to it. And the more that both those things go on, the further we're going to be ahead. So, yes, it would be a problem if you do it in the sense it's more like what the bourgeoisie does. You know, let's just find a few great people and put everything in their hands. That's actually, ironically, more the bourgeois way of doing things, even though they deny that they have cults of the personality. I mean, we've just been through all this Reagan, you know. But also, you know, they're defending an old way of life. And, you know, they have a lot of the advantages that go with being the entrenched system, the entrenched ruling class. And they can bring forward a lot of people to administer their system relatively competently for their needs. But we're trying to go up against the whole way the world is and make innovations and breakthroughs in order to do that have to be on a world, you know, world historic level, because that's what we're up against. And we do have unevenness. You know, we haven't, because we're not the ones who have been you know, on the top of the top of the struggle for a while, and chasing the imperialists to a few corners and running them out of the world altogether. Now, we're not at that stage yet. We represent the forces that are rising, but haven't yet gotten the upper hand. Let's put it that way. So, it's more difficult for us to have as many people who have as advanced an understanding and can lead as it will be possible for us to do further along in the struggle, when we've overcome more of these oppressive divisions in society. And you can't sort of start the discussion about this in the middle. You have to go back to the beginning or down to the foundation of it. Why do you need leaders in the first place? Why are there unevennesses within a movement or within a party? Why is there uneven development? Why are some people more advanced than others? Why is there, yes, a very significant gap between an organized, conscious vanguard of people and broader masses of people? Is this because the people who were in that organized vanguard went out to create this gap? Or, in fact, is their mere existence as a vanguard a reflection of this gap, an expression of this gap? That, you know, 90% of the people or more in the world, many of them, frankly, can't even read and write because of the workings of the system and what it denies to them. But even those who can, most of them are weighed down by the daily struggle for survival and bombarded with the ideology of the ruling class, to where on their own spontaneously they may rebel, they may see important aspects of the truth about the world and about society and about what's wrong with it, but they can't come to a systematic, comprehensive understanding that enables them to get past all the obstacles that lie in the way of really changing that. At any given time within a society like this, given this tremendous gap between most people who are in that kind of situation and a small number who have access to and who work with ideas and wrangle in the realm of theory and all that, it's going to be among those, the latter group, that you're first going to get people who come to this understanding, who break through and sort of get a penetrating insight into how the society and the world actually works and what's the motion and development through history of that and where is it all tending and where does it need to go and how can it get there. That's why you have this gap. I mean, I was talking the other day with you about the movie Contact, where, you know, this character played by Matthew McConaughey says to the Jodie Foster character, who's sort of an atheist, "Well, what makes you think you know so much? 95% of the people in the world believe in God. What makes you so smart?" Well, she happens to be right. There is no God, you know, because she's been able to be in a position where she's been able to study and learn about reality and wrestle with questions of theory and philosophy and science and come to that understanding. 95% of the people who believe in religion, most of them, haven't been able to do that. Some have and go to religion for other reasons, but most of them have never even had the opportunity to do that. So, you know, is that her fault? Is something wrong with her? Or is that a reflection of what's wrong with the world? And this really is the same with a leadership, with a vanguard party, or with individual leaders. There are people who, we were talking earlier about some of my experiences. Well, part of it was being in a situation where there was lots of intellectual ferment and being in a position and frankly having the opportunity and even the luxury, coming from a middle class family, to be able to have the time to get into all these kind of things and debate them and not be dragged down by every, you know, all the weight of society on you, which is partly what youth are able to do anyway, but then there's a class differentiation. If you're from the bottom of society and all everything is weighing on you the way it does, it's difficult to break through that. Some people do. Like I was talking with someone the other day who's an intellectual who comes out of very desperate circumstances, and I asked him, "Well, how did you, you know, get to be that?" And he said, "Well, just one year I couldn't get any work, I couldn't do anything, I read every book I could get my hands on." You know, so that happens, but it's pretty rare, and you'll find it in prison. You know, a few people in prison, for their sanity or whatever, start reading, they start writing, and they start investigating, studying lots of things, and they've become into, you know, quote-unquote self-made intellectuals. But let's face it, most people in prison are going to be ground down by what goes on there and are not going to be able to do that. Well, whether you come from prison or whether you come from the circumstances of this person who is literally living on the street a lot of the time, or from my circumstances, wherever you come from, if you come to a certain understanding and you see that there are, you know, not only the world needs to be changed, but there are forces in society who could bring about that change and need that change, then you go to them with the understanding that you've developed and you bring them forward. But there is going to be unevenness, and where you have people who do have this understanding, they shouldn't be shamefaced about it or defensive about it or, you know, not wanting to exert influence on other people. They should not have an arrogant attitude. They should recognize they have a tremendous amount to learn from people who are going through the hell of this society every day. But also they have important things to bring to people. And there should be that dialectical process, that back and forth process, so that you're bringing forward masses of people who are the ones who are eventually going to bring this change. But you're also, at any given time, cherishing and defending the leadership you have that has emerged, that does have this advanced understanding and can link it with the practical conditions of the mass of people and with their, you know, with their own desire to find a way out of the world that they're chained in, and can bring them forward on that basis. And so I see this more in that kind of way. And wherever in the world and whenever we get leaders who do have a developed capacity, going back to what you were saying at the very beginning of our conversation about someone commenting about how I combine theory and, you know, sort of an understanding of how to bring this to masses of people. Well, I, you know, want to be able to do that even better, but I think objectively there is some truth, some important truth to that. And where that emerges, then that's a very valuable and precious thing for the struggle. But without, you know, and that should be recognized and it should be defended, because it's not easy for something like that to be brought forward by the whole mass upsurge of the people, which is really where I came from, and other people who do come to this kind of position. And, you know, you combine that with studying theory, but without that impulse from the mass of people that we've been talking about, I wouldn't have even wanted to take up that theory or seen the need to or been inclined to. So it's that whole back and forth that's important. And so where you do have these leaders, you should recognize it. You should recognize how important it is, how much the enemy wants to destroy that. You know, and they have people who study this, and they don't wait until you have a massive influence. They want to sit mm-hmm. around and find out how well you're going to do. As soon as they see anything emerging like that, they're going to start developing their tactics for how to crush that and eliminate it. On the other hand, the role of people like that is to bring forward growing numbers of people, including among those who can be and have to be the driving force for this whole revolution. That's the whole, you know, orientation and objective that I'm pursuing, is you know, together with and through our party as a whole, and leading the party to do this, to bring forward that base of people, and to bring forward people broadly, and you build a broad united front with that basic proletarian force, of, you know, sort of the driving thrust within all that, to make this revolution, and then to begin transforming society to where individuals increasingly don't play such what you might call disproportionate influence. You know, that they aren't, their importance isn't out of proportion to that of others in the society. But in order to get to that, we have to get rid of this system and its oppressive divisions, including this whole mental manual contradiction that is what I've really been talking about. You know, those few who will work with ideas and work with their minds, and the many who work with their backs and their hands if they can work at all. But you can't get rid of that contradiction by wishing it away or pretending it doesn't exist. It's that contradiction in large part that gives rise to the need for leaders and for a vanguard. And then the contradiction goes forward and becomes, how does that vanguard move society, leading the mass of people to move society forward to eventually eliminate that contradiction and the need for that vanguard? And all along the way, yes, that vanguard can turn into its opposite, and leaders can turn to theirs opposite. That's, you know, that's the contradictory nature of what we're doing. You can't do this without a vanguard, and yes, it can be turned into its opposite, and we have to struggle to resolve that in a forward-moving way to get to where leaders and vanguards, in the sense we're talking about them, are no longer necessary and won't, you know, will go out of existence and be replaced by the more collective process of the masses of people without those kinds of distinctions of mental labor and manual labor and the role of particular individuals being such a, you know, heavy one, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, and I think one thing, I mean, you know, the question that's actually behind a lot of this stuff about leaders and communism, I mean, the big question that's always sort of in the room and, mm-hmm. you know, is in a way, it's the first thing that comes up is, okay, you've had some experience around this stuff, Stalin. And I know that's a big, big question, but, you know, it's something that I think, you know, look, a lot of listeners on KPFK, for instance, that's the big question around this. You know, immediately they go right to that, Stalin, totalitarianism.
Well, that is a big question. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of as there is with, you know, these days with Mao, even with Stalin, there's a lot of distortion. And there, you know, Stalin did lead the development of the first socialist country in the world against very difficult odds. And a lot lot of times when people talk about this, you know, they, especially in American society, you're sort of conditioned to think of everything through the prism of the way, you know, this society is now, and, you know, not to even know about, let alone to really think about the implications of things like the fact that the, you know, that Stalin came to leadership after a period in which there was a revolution and a civil war, which, you know, left the country in a shambles because it came out of the context of World War I to begin with. And, you know, the economy was broken down. There was a question of could they do anything in terms of rebuilding the economy, and in particular, could they do it along socialist lines, or did they basically have to give up that idea once there was not a revolution in large parts of the world besides Russia? And, you know, Stalin was the one who came forward and led people in actually building a socialist economy without any prior experience and in very difficult circumstances where increasingly they were facing a threat of attack which did come from Germany, and which, you know, a lot of people that don't even people consider themselves educated don't know or don't or forget about or don't realize the full implications of the fact they lost 20 million or more people in World War II in the Soviet Union. I mean, that was out of a population of less than 200 million at that time. So think about that. You know, you're losing more than a tenth of the population. Think about what that would mean in the U.S. and what the effects that would be. And that was looming before them and over them for much of the time that Stalin was leading the Soviet Union. And you combine that with the fact that it was a backward country where 80% of the people were peasants. It had been less than 100 years since they'd been freed from literal serfdom. That happened at the same time as the Civil War in the U.S. It was one of the two major changes in the world going on at that time was the abolition of slavery in the U.S. and the abolition of outright serfdom, where the serfs were virtually, if not literally, owned by the landlords in Russia. That happened only in the 1860s. And they weren't very far from that. And there was, you know, tremendous backwardness in the country, even though it was a empire run by the Tsar, the country itself was largely backward. So you had all these things, that the obstacles that Stalin had to go up against with no prior experience. And yet, you know, great achievements were brought about, not just in industrialized the country, but also in terms of the health care, the living standard, the people, the role of the, you know, the working class in remaking industry and changing the relations, all that kind of stuff, and the peasantry in the countryside, you know, and the abolition of tremendous and horrendous forms of oppression of women in the Soviet Union. You can imagine it was a society that was still, you know, heavily steeped in feudalism, a lot of religious fundamentalism and absolutism in different forms throughout the society, and tremendous advances for women. All that's on the positive side and is usually blotted out and ignored. And, you know, it's more contradictory than that. Even the positive stuff is more contradictory. But it's important to situate this in the realities of what they're up against, and also the realities of what was positively accomplished. And then there were some real weaknesses on Stalin's part that increased the more the difficulties became acute. And the more, in particular, they could see that war was looming, you know, and particularly in the form of an attack from Nazi Germany once Hitler came to power in the, you know, 33 and beyond in Germany during that decade of the 1930s. So, you know, Stalin, you know, made a lot of errors, partly because of the difficulty of the circumstance, but also partly because of his methodology. Mao once jokingly or half-jokingly said about Stalin that he was raised, you know, educated in a religious seminary. He never really shed that outlook completely. And that translated into his being sort of mechanical, wooden, a tendency to be wooden, to see things in absolute terms, and, you know, just the sort of the way the absolutist religion was at that time, and, you know, the whole... And, yes, to have certain influences of patriarchy and things like that that came from that whole tradition. And although he shed a lot of that, Mao's point was there were a lot of it that remained in how he approached problems. And, you know, he, as Mao also put it, Stalin tended, in significant ways and in growing ways as the threat to the Soviet Union grew in the 30s especially, to mix up two different kind of contradictions, as Mao identified them. Those among the people, making up more than 90% of the society, and those between the people and the enemy, the old overthrown exploiters, and actually active, conscious counter-revolutionaries who were sabotaging and trying to destroy the economy and trying, you know, some of them were even collaborating with the Germans. But in one way or another, and through one form or another, we're trying to bring back the old capitalist society. Stalin tended to mix those things up, and that increasingly became a problem the more acute the dangers to the Soviet Union became. And I think there was also a thing where Stalin, and this has been a broader problem in our movement that we're struggling to root out, you know, you, you start becoming convinced, or you become convinced that you represent the wave of the future. And then everything that opposes you, and this goes along with mixing up these two different kind of contradictions, but trying to get at a specific or particular aspect of this, everything that opposes you, criticizes you, dissents from what you're doing, can be just sort of too readily dismissed and too readily cast into the camp of people who are bound to, you know, take things back to capitalism. Now, some people are going to criticize you when you're building socialism, do want to go back to capitalism. But many people don't actually want to, and even sometimes their ideas would objectively lead that way, but that's not where they're consciously coming from. And these things have to be sorted out, not just by a few leaders, but by the masses of people. They have to be thrashed out. They have to struggle out, and they have to be increasingly developed a form for them to struggle out. What is really in the interest of the broad mass of people? What is the way forward to uproot these long, you know, centuries-long chains of oppression in various forms? And what is the way to remake the world and join with people throughout the world in the revolutionary struggle to get beyond all this and get to a whole new era of human history? People have to thrash those things out. And there was a tendency, a very marked tendency in Stalin, but it's not limited to him, that sort of, you know, we know the way, and anybody who opposes us is not only, you know, might be wrong, which they might be, or they might be right, but is trying to take us a whole different way. And I think that there was this tendency increasingly set in. And the more that necessity impinged on them in terms of the dangers, and the more that Stalin felt they had to kind of go through a breakneck race to industrialize and arm themselves in a heavy way to be able to deal with this military threat, the more there was, you know, any air to breathe or room allowed for experimentation, for criticism, for dissent, for people, you know, trying to strike out in different directions and see how that could all be part of the process, and for the masses to get involved in struggling out what really is the way forward out of all this, and not just the way with a capital T, capital W, like there's only, as if there's only one way, but many different pathways which all ultimately have to be directed toward, or, you know, have to find their way toward the, and be led toward the goal you have, but make, you know, find a lot of different pathways there. It isn't just, I don't think that you can advance way to the process that I'm talking about by one straight, narrow highway. I think that was an understanding that Stalin didn't have, or increasingly lost sight of. And that, you know, how, it's a real challenge. How do you have a society in which you have a lot of ferment, and you have a lot of dissent, and you have people proposing and struggling for different things, and yet you do all sort of find the way to keep that all, you know, put your arms around that in the sense of an embrace, not in the sense of suffocating it. But, you know, reach out broadly enough and get your arms around all that so you can lead all of it to go forward without suffocating it and without constricting it. And so the mass of people get involved in actually thrashing these things out and determining what's the way forward. So there was a lot of that was missing in Stalin. It was too much like, you know, this is the way forward, we know it, we go, you know, we're going to go 1, 2, 3, and anybody who opposed that or has any other idea can only be working for the enemy. And that increasingly became the problem, as I said, as a necessity increasingly, and it was a real necessity. I mean, when the Soviet Union was invaded, you know, they talk all about World War II, but they don't talk very much about it. When the Soviet Union was invaded, a lot of their industry was destroyed, whatever the Nazis could get their hands on was either taken or destroyed. And, you know, there was in the Russian winter, you know, people were going without heat because they were under siege. People were eating wallpaper off the walls in Moscow, you know, to try to survive this siege that lasted a year or whatever. And people, you know, you can't divorce the errors that were made from those circumstances on the one hand. On the other hand, you can't just use those circumstances as a way to dismiss all the methodological questions that have to be summed up much more deeply and critically in order to see how, yes, in circumstances in the future where we're going to face similar kinds of necessity, we can do much better with it and yet not be crushed and defeated.
You know, it's interesting, too. I think, I mean, the answer you're giving is, you know, refreshing and actually, in a way, it's, you know, it really does put it in the proper context and perspective. I think, actually, though, the thing that a lot of people still come down to, it comes down to people saying, look, you can talk about methodological errors. You can talk about, you know, all this stuff. But you're still talking about, look, it wasn't just errors. It ended up in people being killed, people being shunted off to gulags and dying and disappearing. And that they portray this as not, you know, they portray it as a reign of terror, you know.
And now, granted, a lot of this stuff comes from people like Solzhenitsyn, who actually was, you know, they always conveniently forget to say that he was actually advocating and fighting to bring back the Tsar until the day he died.
Right.
But this is still a question that comes up. It's like, look, there were deaths here. There were, you know, there was this reign of terror that was unleashed, not just a squashing of dissent, but a reign of terror.
Well, when I talk about methodological errors, I don't mean to talk about this as if it's detached from what happens to real people. When you are leading anything, and especially a society, and having a major impact in the world, when you make errors, especially serious errors, people suffer for that. You know, that's part of what is involved in taking responsibility for something like this. And so I'm acutely aware that people suffer. When you mix up the two kinds of contradictions and you repress, you know, people who are just raising disagreements or dissenting, even if their dissent is really off base and it really will cause problems if you were to implement their policies, then, you know, when you mix that up and mishandle that, and when your methodology leads you to do that, which is the point I was making, then yes, people do suffer real consequences. Now, I think it's still necessary to study more and sort out more what, you know, the slanders, fabrications, and distortions that come from people like Solzhenitsyn's and the Solzhenitsyn's and the imperialists who promote them in that whole viewpoint, and what was the reality of what happened. And it's complicated to do this. You know, I know someone who studies these things who told me that, you know, now that they have, you know, Putin in there, and then now that they've thrown aside the mask of socialism altogether and the Soviet Union is no longer in existence, well, now we're supposed to believe that everything that these people, you know, claim to dig out of the archives from the old Soviet Union is the gospel truth. You know, before, when they were KGB agents, everything they said was a lie. Somehow now they're disinterested people who everything they say about the past, which they're interested in discrediting themselves to a significant degree, is somehow that's the gospel truth and shouldn't be questioned or looked at critically. So we need a more critical approach in that, and it is difficult to sort out, but we need to sort out more what actually did happen. I mean, I've read things like, you know, Arno Mayer's book, The Furies, about the use of terror and repression in the French Revolution as well as the Russian Revolution. And his figures on the number of people who were, you know, sent to gulags, quote-unquote, was a lot lower than what's usually cited. And, you know, I don't know if that's the whole picture, but it's certainly part of what we need to be learning from. And there needs to be more digging into this. But I will say that there were people who were wrongly repressed, that there wasn't the kind of vigorous, especially after the mid-30s. There was some earlier, but even then not enough. But especially after the mid-30s, there wasn't a kind of vigorous ferment in society and struggle over the road forward and clashing of different ideas and opinions. But look, it's not so simple as just, you know, everything that comes from a section of the mass of people is always right. You know, if that were the case, we'd be way ahead of where we are in the world right now. You know, things are contradictory and complicated. This, you know, big, you know, problem, a big condemnation of the Soviet Union's role in the Spanish Civil War. You know, we wrote a whole article after studying this in a magazine, Revolution, a number of years ago, actually about 20 years ago now. And a lot of people, you know, think that the problem with the Soviet Union or the Communist Party following the Soviet Union in Spain was they were too centralized, you know. Well, that wasn't the essential problem. The essential problem was their line, which they were subordinating the struggle in Spain to the Soviet Union's attempts to make, you know, deals with the, you know, come into agreements with France and Britain in particular against Germany, against the Nazis, because of the threat they were perceiving. You actually did need a lot of centralization in that army in order to effectively fight Franco and all the backing that he had. That, you know, and a lot of the anarchist programs were programs that would have actually undermined the necessary struggle, and they actually reflected the interests of a lot of, you know, small artisans and petty bourgeois forces, as we analyzed in that article, or they did represent sections of workers, but whose programs would have pitted their interests against the larger interests of the working class and the people, you know, who were part of the Republican struggle as a whole. So, you know, it's not always. This came up in the Chinese Revolution, for example. As described in Fan Chen, there was the poor peasants who were the poorest of the poor in the countryside and landless to a large degree. They wanted to expropriate everything of everybody above them, even the relatively not well-off, you know, lower sections of the middle peasantry, as it was defined. And there had to be struggle against that, because had their program been implemented, they would have very quickly found themselves back in the same situation, perhaps with a slight reshuffling of who was where in the polarization. But they wouldn't have been able to break out of the overall poverty, because that required going out a completely different way of moving for, you know, through cooperative labor to cooperative ownership and collective ownership of the land, and a whole program like that, and not just eating up whatever was at hand at a given time, which would have, there wasn't very much to eat up. Mm-hmm. And you would have just been redistributing poverty at best. And so, and a lot of the forces that they wanted to expropriate were people you should have been aligning with and working together with as you move from, you know, individual ownership to cooperative labor to cooperative ownership and then larger collectives of ownership of peasants as the way out of the poverty of the countryside. And it was the Communist Party that understood this and struggled against this poor peasant line. And sometimes, you know, it was a pretty sharp struggle. You could say, well, look at the Communist Party, it's betraying the poor peasants. It wasn't, actually. It was actually fighting for their interests in a way that spontaneously some of them weren't seeing and were acting against. And the same thing happened in the Soviet Union at times, or in the Spanish Civil War. So it's complex. Just because a section of the masses, for example, might rebel against the government doesn't mean the government is wrong in every situation. It depends on what the program of these different forces is. Now, if a section of the masses rebels against a government that's a socialist government, the government and the leaders of the society should struggle very hard to have that resolved non-antagonistically as a contradiction among the people. But it's not always possible to completely do that. And that this is what makes for the complexities of things. If certain interests are being insisted upon by a section of the masses, that it would actually undermine the overall interests of the proletariat, then you can't go along with that. You know, in other words, say you raise the wages of a section of the working class, but the effect of that is to actually undermine the accumulation for expanding the socialist economy as a whole, which over a little longer period would raise the standard of living of the working class and masses of people much more broadly. Well, you have to fight against that line, because maybe that wage increase, while it might be a good trade union demand under capitalism, is actually working against the advance of socialism and even the interests of the workers who are raising it in a more fundamental sense. The point I'm trying to make here is this is complex. And the point of orientation has to be to look at the larger interests of the, you know, formerly exploited and oppressed mass of people who are now becoming the masters of the social society, and wage a struggle for them to raise their sights to that larger picture and even to the world as a whole and the world revolution. You know, for example, people in China made sacrifices to support the Vietnamese. They raised rice to get to the Vietnamese because a lot of the rice production was being destroyed by the bombing and the war, you know, that the U.S. was carrying out in Vietnam. Well, that was a struggle, because people, you know, were coming out of generations of not just poverty but starvation in China, and they had the great leap forward, you know, and they were still recovering from some of the problems that arose in that, and they did recover quickly, which is the first time in the history of that country that, you know, that very quickly after there was some real, you know, privation or even starvation, they quickly solved the problem, and for the first time in the early 60s or by the mid 60s, China had essentially solved its food problem, meaning people were getting basic foodstuffs to be able to live on, which hadn't happened before in the history of that country. And this was only 15 years after the revolution succeeded, essentially. So sometimes you have to actually struggle against the demands that come from a section of the masses of people, even though they're, you know, you can see why those demands come, and it's speaking to a real need of theirs, because if you actually accede to that, you're going to undermine the basis for raising the whole level of the people. And in that case, you know, you undermine the basis to support an important struggle in another part of the world. So these are the kind of things we need to dig into more deeply. I'm just trying to say that people who fall into these notions that, well, you know, they put down this rebellion or whatever, sometimes are not looking at it from the point of view of the larger relations in the society and what it would have meant to accede to a certain demand from a section of the masses, even if they had real grievances. And that, you know, and that goes back to my point that when you're talking about sections of the masses of people and not overthrown exploiters or conscious counter-revolutionaries, you should seek to resolve that non-antagonistically, as Mao put it, as a contradiction among the people. But sometimes that, in the short run, that's not always possible, because wherever in a social society there are grievances, here's what makes it complicated. Stalin was wrong the way he dealt with a lot of things. He did, you know, treat contradictions among the people many times as contradictions with the enemy. But the complication is the enemy does get in there. You know, the masses have grievances, and then the enemy fans those grievances to try to undermine the whole thing. And it becomes very complex, because these two different contradictions, those among the people and those between the people and the enemy, get mixed in together and meshed together, and it's hard to sort them out sometimes. So I think there's a lot to learn in terms of how we can do better, but what I'm really struggling for is an orientation of really looking at the problems, the way they actually present themselves and all their complexity, and from the point of view of advancing to where this all needs to go, and not from a narrow trade unionist point of view, which is frankly what a lot of anarcho-syndicalists and Trotskyite and other criticisms of the Soviet Union under Stalin's leadership come at it from, that kind of a trade unionist or anarcho-syndicalist point of view, which is not really the point of view of how we're going to move, transform the whole society and raise the whole level of everybody up and eliminate these, the chains on people to get to a whole different kind of world. But it's more narrow and economist, as Lenin called it, more like, how does a particular section of the people improve their living or working conditions right now? And yes, we should do that in an overall sense, but there are times when that can come into a contradiction, even acute contradiction, with raising the whole level up.
That was Bob Avakian, from the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we will be taking a short break, and when we come back, this is when we